This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your producer today is Robin Dow, and the number to reach her and to engage our guest, if you so choose, is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We begin with one of the most celebrated sports writers alive, Dave Kindred. He's had a long and storied career in a few different venues, and his career has been varied as to who he has written about and the people he has experienced. He's written personal stories, and also he has rubbed shoulders with many of the luminaries of our world. And good morning to you, Dave Kindred.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Well, last time you were with us, it's been a few years. You had just written Sound and Fury about Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali, and it was a great book about this unusual relationship between the preeminent sportscaster of his day and the greatest athlete on the planet, then and maybe of all time, Muhammad Ali. Let's start there. When you were, I think, 24 years old, you forged a relationship with Muhammad Ali. You were working in Louisville for the Courier Journal. You were born just a few months apart, and it was a special relationship between two people from different backgrounds. Tell us more.
Well, Louisville Courier Journal was my first, quote, big time, unquote, job. I began there as a copy editor. I was a writer, but they didn't have a writer's job open, so I took the copy editing job. And I would come into the office early, try to find a story. The sports editor at the time, Earl Cox, told me that if I found a story, they would put it in the paper. So I would go in there every day. Sometimes I took my son, 2-3 years old, with me, babysitting while trying to find a story. One day, a boss, and everybody was my boss at that time, came in and said, "Clay's in town. Go find him." The Courier Journal at that time still called him Cassius Clay. This was 1966, 2 years after he became the heavyweight champion. So I took my son, we got in the car and went into the west end of Louisville where Ali had grown up and found him. It was very easy to find him, by the way, Jim. All you had to do was say, "Anybody seen Cassius?" Everybody had seen Cassius because he was making a tour of all his old haunts. So spent the day with him. Wrote about him. He carried my son around, kind of my secondary babysitter. And then I wrote about him for the next 50 years. And he was, as you said, the preeminent athlete of his time. I believe he was the greatest athlete I ever saw or ever expect to see. And I had a great relationship with him in the sense that I was always fascinated by everything he did, everything he said. We're not supposed to talk about race, religion, or politics. He talked about race, religion, and politics all the time. So I was fascinated by him, covered 17 of his fights, 10 of his heavyweight championship fights. And I had no idea at the time. I was 24 years old. No idea at the time that I didn't really recognize how big he was, because I was very close to him all that time. But certainly now that 50 years later, I know that it was one of the great intersections of my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it all.
A towering figure in the world of sport and pop culture, politics, and a guy who had gifts that were varied. To the extreme, he was, of course, an extremely great fighter, maybe the best ever. And he, of course, was quick with his lips as he was with his fists, and he was beautiful. He was an extremely handsome fellow and had all these gifts. And you have lamented the fact that it did not end well for the champ. And a wise man once told me that it's not what we hate that kills us. It's usually what we love. And in his case, he loved to fight, and he went too long. And the end, it was crushing, wasn't it?
He did go too long, and I think it was more, certainly he loved the combat. He loved the training, even. mostly he loved the attention. And I think in the end, it was the attention that destroyed him. He needed to be in the spotlight all the time. He needed people around him. Celebrities today, most of them hire security people to keep people away. Ali wanted people around him at all times. He wanted the adulation. He wanted the attention. He was a great performer. You know, and I think that once his athletic skills left him, and I've always thought, by the way, Jim, that the two greatest fighters that I ever saw were Cassius Clay and Muhammad Ali.
I love that.
Because when he was Cassius Clay, you couldn't touch him. When he became Muhammad Ali, basically in 64, you know, after he had defeated Liston the first time. And eventually, age caught up to him. You know, the greatest years of any professional athlete's life is 28 to 32. 28 to 32, Ali was exiled. He was, boxing commissions took his license away from him for his refusal to accept the draft. So the greatest years of his athletic life were denied to him. So he, until he's 28, he's Cassius Clay. When he's 32, he's Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali got hit a lot. And eventually that's what produced the Parkinson's in him, reduced him to, he just fought too long, took too many blows. We talk about football players with CTE, brain damage. Imagine getting hit in the head a million times with no helmet on by people who are intending to hurt you. And that's what Ali submitted himself to, because it was his identity. It was his life. And it was sad to see, very sad to see.
And as you wrote in Sound and Fury, he had this unusual relationship with Howard Cosell. And in a way, they brought out the best in each other. And I think they liked each other, but it wasn't all champagne and roses either. Tell us about that relationship.
Well, I thought that I met Ali in 66. I met Cosell in 79. I knew Cosell the last 15 years of his life. Again, I was fascinated by the character, you know, and he didn't like media, most media. I was fascinated by that. I became friends with Cosell because I respected his opinions. I respected his performance. And I've said before, and I think I said in that book, Sound and Fury, I said in that book that Ali and Cosell were the first and the last of their kind. Everyone in boxing came along, tried to be Muhammad Ali. Sugar Ray Leonard tried to be Ali. Every sportscaster came along and wanted to be Howard Cosell. I mean, you can hear Stephen A. Smith on ESPN now. He's trying to be Howard Cosell now, at a time when people don't even remember who Cosell was. But you're such a powerful performer and a powerful thinker. I think that's what people forget about Cosell. You know, he was ahead of his time on almost everything in sports. And they were a perfect match. You know, Cosell and Ali, the perfect match in ego. I mean, no one had a bigger ego than Ali. But Cosell tried, and Cosell knew that he would have to be second banana to Ali. He was willing to accept that, and they had fun together. You know, they knew their act. They knew what worked, and it was good for both of them.
It was, and Cosell was another one who loved the spotlight. I recall the story of Cosell walking into a game when he was doing Monday Night Football with Frank Gifford and Don Meredith, and the fans they're cheering and jeering Howard Cosell, but making a big ruckus as they go in, all three of them. And Cosell says to the two of them, he says, "Gentlemen, can you feel the adulation?"
Of course. You know, Howard was, as I said, and I've said this before, I may have said it in the book, that Cosell was more Cosell off the air than he was on the air, if you can imagine that. But he did make a show of his arrival on all, at every scene.
Well, a listener asks, and it's pertinent, yesterday we had another big showdown between Patrick Mahomes and Joe Burrow, the LSU Heisman winner from 2019, and Kansas City and Cincinnati seem to have a rivalry for the ages, and Kansas City won, and they go to the Super Bowl against Philadelphia. But Burrow and Mahomes are stories that guys like you love.
Well, I didn't know Joe Burrow until I saw him at LSU, of course. I'd missed him, as most of America had missed him, when he was at Ohio State, I believe.
Yep.
Comes to LSU, and so I certainly saw him a lot there.
Okay, we do have to take a 90-second pause, but we'll pick up with Burrow and Mahomes with Dave Kindred after this quick pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Dave Kindred, the great sports writer, and that word is often overused, but Dave fits the bill. His career has been varied. He does not have what Howard Cosell once called dugout vision. He has interests that go way beyond the games people play. But yesterday in Kansas City for the AFC Championship, Joe Burrow lost to Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs 23-20, field goal 45 yards at the buzzer. But Burrow may be the most charismatic quarterback. We've had some that I think are extremely charismatic and won lots of world titles in Joe Montana and Tom Brady. But the comparison to him and Joe Namath has been inevitable. Of course, different personalities, but you and I are old enough to remember Broadway Joe, and back in the late 60s, Dave, when he won the Super Bowl, he was the bomb.
Well, and I think Joe Burrow, you know, has years to go yet. The thing I like about the that game yesterday and the rivalry that will go on for years now is the fact that it will go on for years. You know, Kansas City had lost three straight times to Cincinnati. You know, if that kept going, you know, there'd be no real rivalry. But now it's 3-1. Kansas City finally beat Burrow. I love the moment after the game when Kelsey puts his head into Mahomes' interview and makes a kind of a comic insult about Burrowhead Stadium. You know, I love Joe Burrow. You know, he really is a classic quarterback. You know, and I think they're both young now. What's he, 24, 23?
Well, he had a long stay in college, so actually he is 26. But
26. But Mahomes is what, 27? Yeah. You know, they both have another maybe 10 years. The way that quarterbacks are protected now in the league, you know, so we'll see them a lot of times. And they'll trade victories back and forth.
Dave Kindred, as I noted, has logged many years as a sports writer, and he gets featured on 60 Minutes, and that's a rarity for a sports writer. But, Dave, this was regarding your latest work, and this one had nothing to do with really famous people like Namath or Ali. Tell us about what got you a call from 60 Minutes.
Well, the call from 60 Minutes, of course, was a great surprise. I've been called by many news organizations, ESPN primarily, you know, because they want to pick my brain or they want a soundbite about Pete Maravich or Dale Brown. And so I provide that. I figured 60 Minutes was doing something, and it turned out that they wanted to do something on me. Well, you know, I don't know what you do if 60 Minutes says we want to do a profile of you, but I said, huh? What? You know, and so it was a great moment in my life, and it was occasioned by the fact that, you know, I used to be somebody. You know, I used to be a big-time sports columnist, and in, quote, retirement, unquote, I had moved back home to Central Illinois and found myself writing 300 times about a girls' high school basketball team. So I think the combination of those elements from going big time to going to girls' high school basketball fascinated the people at 60 Minutes. That's what led to that. And I've been doing the girls' Morton, Illinois high school girls basketball games for 13 seasons now.
Wonderful.
And I've loved it.
Yeah, I can tell. And Dave, you wrote a book, an extremely personal book, about your grandson. And that's something most sports writers wouldn't go there. Most writers might not go there, but you did.
Well, it was never a question of would I go there or not. It was a question of how can I not do this? I had to do that. I loved that boy in ways that truly I had not loved anyone ever. And to watch his life disappear into alcoholism, you know, he left home, became a kind of a modern hobo, riding trains around America, you know, kept drinking, couldn't stop drinking, he was addicted. You know, I wanted to do a book that told people that this was not a character flaw, this was not a moral failing, this was a disease. This was an addiction that he couldn't lick. You know, a lot of people fight addiction themselves or in their family. And I wanted to show that this was a good person. This was a good kid. Everyone loved him. If I had done the reporting on the book and found out that he was not the kid that I thought he was, I would not have done it. But everyone I talked to, you know, it was the same Jared that had grown up with me, who had slept with me when he was 3 years old. I would put him to bed with sports stories about Ali or Pee Wee Reese or Pele. Hmm. And I had to write the book. I could not write the book. My agent couldn't find anyone interested in it. I said, I'll publish it myself. Well, we finally found a publisher, Public Affairs, and I did the book. It took a long time. You know, besides the reporting, my wife during my reporting had a stroke, so I put it off for a couple of years, but came back to do it. Leave out the tragic parts, and I left out none of the tragic parts. It's a hard book to read, it's painful, but I hope that it helps someone who has someone in their family suffering from addiction, whatever it is. And so I'm very proud of that book now.
As you should be. Dan Downtown. Dan, you're on with Dave Kindred.
Yes. Does that Joe Burrow Heisman acceptance speech indicate he may have the empathy for a career in progressive politics?
Did you?
I know nothing about. Well, I know nothing about that one.
Yeah. Well, he commented about homeless people and hungry people in his hometown in Ohio, and they were bombarded with contributions. And I would think
I'm happy to hear that.
And Joe Burrow, if he ever wants to run for governor of Louisiana, I think he's got a good shot. And it, just like with Ali, it doesn't hurt to be handsome, and he's a good-looking guy. He stands out in the crowd, and if he can stay healthy, going to be immensely popular over the next decade or so. Before we leave, Dave, you also have a close friendship with Dale Brown. You mentioned him, and I recall back in 1987 when Bobby Knight and Dale Brown were having their feud, you suggested they should take it to the World Wrestling Federation and make millions.
I think Dale first proposed a wrestling match.
Naked in a closet, remember?
Yes. I don't think that would go over big on pay-per-view, but I like the concept.
Yeah, Dale's a tough guy, and he's 87 years old, and people who have encountered
him. Still tough, I know that.
Yeah, still tough. Still wakes up every day looking to right the wrongs in the world, and sometimes the wrongs are against him. There's one case in particular right now, as we know. But Dave Kindred, have you ever met anyone like him?
No, never a coach like him. And I loved him every time I was around him. I learned something. I profited from the experience, whether it was for the comedy of it or for the serious nature hidden in the comedy. I thought Dale was a great coach, thought he was a better human being, and I always loved being around him and loved talking to him, and I learned from him. You know, my favorite thing always was having Dale go off on one of his long orations and just making notes of the various names he would drop in, whether it was Jiminy Cricket or Jesus Christ or Muhammad Ali. You know, he was always entertaining while being educational. I love Dale.
Well, it is an honor and pleasure to talk with Dave Kindred, and hopefully we will have you back. And I want to hear about the prospect of Dave writing about his boyhood hero, Stan Musial, one of the great baseball players who played in the era of Mays and Aaron and Clemente and has not gotten his just due. He was one of the greats with 3,630 hits in the St. Louis Cardinals. But Dave Kindred, let's keep it going.
I'm trying to do that, Jim. Thank you very much.
My honor, and thanks for staying the course and staying in the game, Dave Kindred. And we'll be back with Mary Olive Pearson after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And in-house is one of the fabulous attorneys from Louisiana, Mary Olive Pearson, who started her career with the likes of James Carville and Pat Screen and our good friend Sonny Cranch, who is celebrating a birthday today. Happy 79th to Sonny Cranch, born on the same day as Franklin Roosevelt and Dick Cheney. And Jeff Palermo, our news director here at the Louisiana Radio Network. But those were the days. A lot of talented young people in Baton Rouge at the time. And Mayor Screen, Sonny, once told me that he was going down the street in New York, and he goes by Carnegie Hall, and he sees Birmingham Orchestra to perform. And so he goes in and says, "What's this?" He says, "We got a better orchestra or better symphony in Baton Rouge." And they said, "It's Birmingham, England." But you know what? Pat Screen got the Baton Rouge Symphony to perform at Carnegie Hall. He was an amazing guy, and if his demons had not caught him, what would that man have done in his life, Mary Olive?
It's really hard to say, but the way I've described Pat after a couple of mayors after him, Pat was a guy that he would have 20 ideas. One of them might be not so good. 19 would be good. Then we had some mayors, they couldn't have a good idea. And so you'd rather have a guy that's got 20 ideas, one of them's bad, than somebody with no ideas at all. And he mm-hmm. had some ideas. I mean, he had Catfish Town. He did a lot of good things. There's just no telling what he could have done, but for the fact that he had some, as you call them, demons, and they just took a hold. And, of course, we now know in this day and age, 2023, that those demons are affecting a lot of people in this country.
They are. And like him, a lot of people die from those demons because they are lethal. And Pat Screen's life ended at 51. And in May, we'll hopefully have you back on his birthday. I think we need to remember this guy. He would have been 80 years old. And by today's standards, he's younger than Joe Biden. Who knows what Pat Screen might have done?
Look, I'm going to be 79 in 2 weeks. So
on February 11th, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm very familiar with his age. He's the same age as I am. And we graduated from high school the same year, 1962, before a lot of your listeners were even born. But no, there's just no telling what he could have done but for that.
877-217-5757, and Mary Olive is one of our favorite guests. She rolls with the flow, the person who is affectionately called Mop. And Bob Tompkins, formerly of the Alexandria Town Talk, many years sports editor there, he's an occasional listener. He sent me something, and I think those of us of a certain vintage can relate to this. He says, "Jim, my head is spinning. I paid $12.60 for a book of 20 standard postage stamps. As of today, the cost of a single stamp is 63 cents. In 1958, he says, the year you were born, a stamp cost 4 cents. 1971, it was 8 cents. When Bill Clinton left office in 2001, it was 34 cents. Just over a decade ago, 45 cents. Today, 63 cents to mail a letter, Mary Olive Pearson. What is going on in our world?
Inflation.
Is it this Biden inflation that's doing this?
Oh, no. Inflation has been coming. I mean, look, you could go back to, I don't know, World War II and find that the price of bread was, you know, less than 50 cents. And today, there's no telling what it is. And, of course, now we hear that eggs are, I don't know, $6 mm-hmm. a dozen.
Yeah, laundry detergent and things like that just wildly inflated from just a year ago.
Cereal. It's like if you get on the cereal aisle and you look at that, mm-hmm. I don't even know how these parents afford cereal for the kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, what in the world's going on? I understand there is a new development in the attempt to establish the Village of St. George, and Mary Olive Pearson has been fighting this as the top legal eagle on the other side, and her side has been winning the latest rounds in court, one after another, but the battle goes on. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is that we did win in the district court, and the judge, who's an ad hoc judge that was appointed to handle the case when our judge retired, decided that they had not met the standard for incorporating a city. So they appealed, and they filed their briefs. We have filed our briefs in the Court of Appeal. They now, in what I think is a sort of a desperate move, they've filed some exceptions in the Court of Appeal, which, A, should have been filed in the district court. Mm-hmm. B, should not have been called exceptions. They should have been called affirmative defenses, which would have changed the burden of proof. And we've responded to that recently. And then their latest attempt, and I'm not sure how it helps them or anybody, they want not a three-judge panel, they want a five-judge panel. Normally when you appeal something, you get a three-judge panel. But they say that we need a five-judge panel. We filed what I called a response, because I'm not opposed to that. I'm not for it either. I think the court can decide whether it wants to put three or five judges to work on this case, which is, by the way, not very complicated. It simply follows the statute that says what you have to prove to either sustain the election, to incorporate, or to defeat the incorporation because it doesn't meet the right standard. It has an adverse impact on a municipality in the area, or they can't do what they said, what they told the voters they could do, which was financially sustain a city of 88,000 people. That's where they are.
But they contend, and obviously they have some people who agree with them, but nobody at a high level in the judiciary, but at least not yet, but that you're trying to overturn an election.
That is, we have said that is false from Jump Street. If anybody knows where Jump Street is, that's where you jump off into what are you going to say. This, we have an election code, and that's in another title of the revised statutes. This is not about the election. This is about Title 33, which the Constitution authorized, in fact, ordered the legislature to adopt a procedure for incorporating new cities. That's exactly what they did, and that's exactly what we followed. We are challenging the incorporation as being something that they can't achieve financially or otherwise without adversely impacting a city in the vicinity, which, by the way, is Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge is a city. And so that's gonna have an adverse impact on that city. This is not an election challenge. We actually stipulated that it was not an election challenge in the trial court. I don't know why they keep saying that, except there's a new thing going around in the last 5 or 6 years that if you say something enough, people think it's true. So they just keep saying that, and I keep saying it's not an election contest. But it's not an election contest.
Okay. 877-217-5757 for Mary Olive Pearson, Robin Dow producing. And as I noted in the promo today, and we talked a bit about it last week, but this Tigerland stuff, that's become a danger zone. And for a young co-ed, it took her life, and now the attorney on the other side is saying that this was a consensual matter, that the people who drove her to a destination where she ended up getting out of the car and wandering the streets with a legal limit four times the level of what the .08 legal standard is for intoxication, she got killed, and she was almost certainly raped. How could somebody consent when they're at that kind of level of intoxication, Mary Olive Pearson?
they absolutely cannot consent at a .319. And I read in the paper that one of those lawyers, maybe all of them, have said they're going to challenge the reading. There's two things we need to know. First of all, if you wanted to challenge it because it was taken by the police and lost in some sort of chain of custody thing, that would be one thing. This was a blood alcohol content that was taken at the hospital. She was already dead. So the chain of custody is the hospital did it, and the hospital did not lose custody. The second thing is this. I don't know the science behind it, but I do know this. If you're a .319 when you're dead at the hospital, you were higher than that at the time of these acts, whatever they were. So the idea, to forget all the science of that, the very idea that a young woman would consent to being raped by two separate individuals that she did not know, as far as we know, she did not know, that night in the backseat of a car, is so far-fetched. I didn't want to call it what it really is as a defense. So I was quoted in the paper accurately. I said, that is the most wackadoodle defense I've ever heard, that she was not drunk. Really? Well, being that drunk is a defense to those claims of consent. You just can't do it. Just like you can't consent when you're underage.
And one of the alleged assailants has been charged before with rape. So,
well, he obviously has a propensity, or at least some people think he does, to that type of conduct. So that's not going to be helpful to him.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Thank you. Wasn't the deceased, may she rest, underage for drinking, please?
Yes, she was under 21. And now we have this situation with people between 18 and 21 going into bars, being allowed to go in legally, but they cannot drink legally. But Mary Olive, as Scott Wilfong, who's on the ABC board, the recently recent chairman, he said, you know, the bars pay a $750 fine and move on. That's not really the kind of punishment that's going to thwart this.
Well, let me be frank about this. If you're going to let somebody under age in a bar and tell them not to drink, you need to go see a doctor, because that ain't happening, okay? Now, let's face it.
Hold that thought. I love where you're going, though. Mary Olive Pearson is with us. 877-217-5757. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased you're with us for Talk Louisiana. Mary Olive Pearson, one of the most astute lawyers and observers of American life and politics, and she knows this community well. The Baton Rouge Horizon right now is troubled by the death of a young co-ed, and I'm reluctant to say her name. I don't think it's particularly relevant. She was a victim, and I can only imagine the pain of her parents to lose a child, beautiful young woman, a student at the Manship School, but to do that and then have her smeared as being in the backseat of a car, willingly having sexual relations with two guys she didn't know, and her blood alcohol level at the hospital was .319. So it appears that a serious crime was committed. 877-217-5757. Certainly the assailants are culpable, but what about the bars and the $750 fine? Is that going to thwart anybody from doing this over and over again? And this is really, usually people don't lose their lives, but quite often they lose their dignity based on actions that are committed when people are intoxicated, lose their inhibitions, and do crazy things. Your thoughts?
$750 means zero to these bar owners. They survive on serving alcohol to minors and over-serving alcohol to minors. They over-serve. Look, when people get over-served, it's generally, for the most part, their own fault, but the bartenders who don't care, the owners don't care. And if you tell them you got to pay $750, they'll get that out of their wallet and pay you. So Scott Wilfong, and we've had disagreements in the past about a lot of things, he is correct. $750 is not a deterrent. You want to deter them? Take their license away. That will deter them. And serving alcohol to minors, which you reminded me during the break, we could lose our federal highway funding if we raise the age to 21. Well,
if we lowered it to 18, rather.
And if you lowered it to 18, right. Yeah, it's 21 now.
Correct.
You lowered it to 18. But then why isn't the Federal Highway Department coming down here and looking and saying, well, you hadn't lowered it, but you're letting them in, and you're serving them alcohol, so we're going to take it away anyway. I mean,
that would stop it, of course.
That would stop it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Patrick in Insualdo Estates. Hello, Patrick. You're on with Mary Olive.
Hey, Mary Olive, I got a legal question. I'm going to play devil's advocate here, but the BAC level of 0.319, don't you think a defense attorney is going to be able to kind of shoot that down? Especially if the lab results were taken on a deceased body, they might be able to say the blood was already fermenting and it had a high alcohol level. What are your thoughts on that from a defense attorney point of view?
Well, I'm not that familiar with the science of all that, but this I do know, that your blood alcohol level, when you stop drinking, it just for a couple of minutes or so, it sort of goes up a little bit, but then it starts to go down a lot. And so at 319 at the hospital, that indicates to me that it was higher than that at the time of these alleged offenses in the backseat of the car that she allegedly consented to.
The bar across from Gino's, Dior, I walked by there the other night, not far from WRKF, by the way. It lost its license with that shooting. And now in the U.S., there have been 6 mass shootings in California this month. There have been more mass shootings in the U.S. this month than there are days. We've got problems with booze, but we also got problems with weapons and people who are using them and killing people by the dozens. Your thoughts?
We could talk for hours on my thoughts about mass shootings and assault weapons that are made for people who are going to war, because that is what is being used to kill dozens of people at one time. I don't know why we haven't done anything about that. I have some ideas that it's what I refer to as the people in the 202 area code. For those of you who don't know, that's Washington, D.C. I don't know what's wrong with them. I don't know why the National Rifle Association has a chokehold on most of those people that keep us from doing something about this. Because we can, but we won't. And prayers, they're really great. They're really great to pray for somebody that's dead so they'll go to heaven, if that's what your beliefs are. But they're not going to bring them back, and they're not going to stop the guy who has the assault weapon from just deciding, well, next week, I think I'll go and kill 12 people.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hello, Phil.
Hey, Jim. Good morning, sir. I think we have to see the photograph of what these weapons do to our children. And I know the politicians, I know Mr. McConnell has seen those pictures, and you cannot unsee them. And I think the world needs to see what happens.
Well, as in Uvalde, those kids were killed beyond recognition. It's not a pretty sight. And once again, to raise a child, and I've never had that wonderful experience, but to lose a child on something like that has to be something you never get over. And I don't think you get past it either. That has to be just devastating.
It's inhuman. The people that do that are not human. Mm-hmm. And we now want to chalk it up, I guess, to mental illness. Some of these people aren't mentally ill. Have we forgotten that there's some people who are just plain evil? They're just plain evil. And when you look at the statistics, except for these two sort of in their 60s people that did these shootings over the weekend in California at the dance halls, most of these people are between 15 and 20.
And it's always a man.
It ain't a woman yet.
Nope. Stuart downtown. Stuart, good morning.
Thank you, Jim, Mary, all of the audience. Good morning, as always. Ms. Pearson, related to the public's ability to comment in a public meeting, when there is no proctor in place and no public comment card fill out, when the chair announces an item to be able to speak on, public comment on an item, and then they send the police to escort you out of the building without having ever spoken to anyone, is that an egregious interruption of one's ability, laws to be able to speak in a public forum?
I'm just not familiar with those facts, but
if you were you, Stuart, I don't know if you're talking personally or not. If that were to happen, I think you would have some legal recourse. So, yeah, if it's a public meeting, you should be allowed to speak. Mitchell and Sherwood, Mitchell, you're on.
Good day to everybody. What I was wondering is, what about that young man that got shot up 3 weeks ago by the place that Sterling got killed? That boy got shot 75 times. Now, that's what we need to be talking about. God bless.
All right. 75 shots will usually do it. Even Carl Austin Weiss was only shot 61 times. But these guns, these weapons, they're so lethal that it's anybody who is in the proximity of a weapon like this is probably going to die if somebody pulls out one and starts shooting. And that's just the fact. This stuff about a good guy with a gun can stop a bad guy with a gun, well, that's easier said than done.
Absolutely. That is not the answer. The answer to this problem is not more guns. The answer to this problem, and everybody wants to, in the 202 area code, they want to take credit for this giant leap forward that they had this gun bill last year that was bipartisan and whatever. The problem with that is it didn't go far enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why they can't just say assault weapons are banned. We did that once,
mm-hmm.
and it worked for 10 years.
Now, I got another message from one Lewis Elwood Woody Jenkins saying that Donald Trump is on his way to whipping Ron DeSantis' butt, that he's going to get the nomination and be the next president. Are you really juiced up about that?
About Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Well, I thought about what I was going to say about Donald Trump to this audience, and I like to read my audience, but I feel comfortable saying Donald Trump is actually the best thing that ever happened to the Democratic Party. Because he is the perfect foil for everything.
That's right.
He's just perfect.
Fundraising.
He cannot do anything right.
And he's never cracked 47%. David in Atlanta. David, you're on.
Good morning. Chuck Schumer said on one of the Sunday morning talk shows before the new House of Representatives took office, when the Democrats had the vote to raise the debt ceiling, he said he'd preferred it to be done in a bipartisan manner. Now we're approaching a crisis, but I think really the Democrats invite the crisis, because when their wealthy donors, when their portfolios crash, I think the Republicans are going to be in a lot of trouble.
What about the debt ceiling and the political implications of causing the government to shut down?
If we allow any party to cause our government to shut down, we are in real trouble. That's my opinion only after looking at everything. And by the way, I got a 401k. I mean, I have money invested in the stock market. I got, you know, savings. I got a retirement. And by the way, they want to cut Social Security. I get Social Security because I'm that old. And so,
well,
but you know, I don't understand why, if it was okay all these years, now it's suddenly not.
Mary Olive, let's keep it going. I'd love to talk with you again soon and very soon. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Stay safe and stay tuned.